So, beginning, could you tell me when you were born, where, and what was your name at birth?
I was born in Krakow, in Poland, on the 14th of January 1932. I was born at home, not in hospital. My father was a lawyer, and I was an only child. They never had any more children because my father was in the next room when I was being born, and he said to my mother, I'll never put you through that again. Anyway, so yes, I was an only child, and I was an only grandchild, so until the age of 7 and a half, I was very lucky. I had a very privileged upbringing, as I realize now. Of course, you don't realize it at the time.
And what was your name then?
Well, my father went to register me, and when he came back, he was supposed to register me as Matilda, because my mother's mother was called Matilda. And unfortunately, my mother's parents were both already dead. They died in their 40s. Very young. And when he came back, he said, he called me Matilda Maria Ludwika. And my mother apparently ran a temperature. But he just wanted to give me these names. I don't know if they were family names or what. So that, but when I came to Glasgow and I went to school, they said, you know, because of Maria, did I want to be called Mary? Because I was never called Matilda or Ludwika. It was in Poland, when you have a name like Maria, you are called Marysia, Marilla, Marina. I mean, there's variations of the name. And so I was used to being called all sorts of things. And I didn't want any of them. I said I'd like to be called Marian, so I've been Marian ever since. My father started Krakow University, and because of all the land that my grandfather had, it wasn't just land, it was a mill, it was a brick factory, it was, and there were, you know, there were byres full of cows and there were horses. I mean, my father rode horses and so on. So he started studying agriculture. Mm-hmm. But then he couldn't stand exams. Exams were too much. So after a year of agriculture, he started something else. So he was studying law when my mother's younger brother started law. And because the parents were dead, my mother took a flat in Krakow in order to keep house for her brother, mm-hmm. of course with a cook and a maid. Mm-hmm. And that's how she met my father, because my uncle brought him home. But when my father wanted to ask her out, she said, oh, you are far too young for me. No. And he said, I'm not as young as you think, because this is about the third faculty I'm in. I've already done this and this. And he would have never finished law if it wasn't for my mother, because he hated exams. He just couldn't stand exams.
I was going to ask, at home, in before you came over, did you speak Polish at home and learnt Russian at school? Or?
Well, at home until 1939, we only spoke Polish at home. But I had a governess. Well, my mother was in a very fortunate position. There was a cook, there was a maid, and for me, a governess. And the stipulation for the governess was that she had to know Hebrew, because I learned Hebrew before I went to school. In Poland, you go to school when you are 7. Well, I was not quite 7, because September you started school. I was 7 in January. I was only 1 year at school in Poland, and it was a Jewish school, a little private school, just 3 or 4 classes. But I had a governess who taught me Hebrew so that I could read and write Hebrew, and I learned little Hebrew songs about Aviron and, all sorts of little Hebrew words, and of course all the Bible stories. Mm-hmm. And for all the Yontevim, we always went to my grandparents, my father's parents, because my mother's parents were long gone. And yes, so that I was, you know, very familiar with all this. But it was only Polish we spoke at home.
Right.
I only learned Russian when we were taken to Siberia. I was 3 years in the first class because, well...
In Russia you were 3 years?
No, no. In the first year at school when I was in Poland and then finished school in June. And, of course, war was very imminent. I actually developed terrible whooping cough and was dreadfully ill. And we were in our holiday house in the country when war broke out. And we never went home. We just went east because my mother's sister was with her son, my cousin, out east where her mother-in-law had a big estate. I'm afraid these families all had big estates. My grandfather had several big estates, and my great-grandfather as well. It just happened to be, you know, that kind of family, so that my mother inherited from her parents, of course, with her siblings, two factories. So, you know, they were very comfortably off. And so we never went home from the holiday house. We went east. Variously by train to begin with, and then by horse and cart, and in various ways, and being bombed on the way by the German planes, you know, coming down. And finally we got to this estate where my aunt was.
So that was still part of Poland?
That was still, well, that used to be part of Poland, you see. We didn't realize that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact had divided Poland across. So we actually had to cross the River Bug, which was the boundary now, at night in a rowing boat, really clandestinely, because we found ourselves in Soviet Russia suddenly. But it used to be Poland, yes. And so we got there. But of course it was a big estate and we stayed there about a week when the Russians came and said, right, you are landowners, out, out. And the peasants said, these people have always been good to us, let them pack up their things and take what they want. Because the Russians would have just, well, we were there only as visitors. But of course my aunt's mother-in-law, she was the owner, and my uncle. Anyway, so we went to live in the town of Brody, which is now in the Ukraine. And so I went to school there to the second class. But all the schools were moved down a year because in Russia you went to school at 8 years old. So I was just 8 that January. So I found myself second time in first class. And we were taught Ukrainian. And then we had to register. The Soviet authorities wanted all these refugees that had come from Western Poland to register whether they would take Soviet citizenship or return to German-occupied Poland. At that time, of course, my parents corresponded with my grandfather and my mother with her brothers, and they said, well, things are not easy, but it's all right. This was still the winter 39-40. And here we were living in a little rented room in very difficult circumstances. So we registered. Well, there was no way we were taking a Soviet citizenship. That was just out of the question. So we registered to go back home. So in June of 1940, everybody who registered to return home to Poland was taken to a big cattle track train, and we were all transported to Siberia. Thousands and thousands of families, thousands. Big trains, cattle tracks packed full of people. It was quite an experience. I mean, we must have been on that train about, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks. I was 8 years old. I don't really know exactly. But I do remember one gentleman saying, as we were passing through a chain of mountains, that we are passing the Ural Mountains, and so now we are in Asia. And it seemed such a thing, being in Asia.
And were you standing during this?
Pardon?
Were you standing during this?
No, there were platforms. A cattle truck, how can I explain it? You know, you've seen it on newsreels.
Of course.
But no, we weren't standing. There were platforms, two platforms on one side and two platforms on the other. But we were like one lying beside the other, absolutely packed. I don't know, maybe 50, 60 people in a cattle truck. And once a day they would bring a sort of bucket with some soup and some bread, if you were lucky. It was just dreadful, dreadful. And the sanitary arrangements were horrendous. You know, if you were a child, it was not so bad.
Yes.
But for my mother, it must have been an absolute culture shock.
Of course. That's absolutely horrific. And in Siberia, was there work for you? Was that
well,
why you were being sent?
We were taken by this train away to the sort of last station, I could show you on the map, last station in Siberia, in the middle of the, you know, what's known as taiga, a sort of primeval forest. And this was on the River Chulim, which is a tributary of the River Ob, which is the big, big river that goes to the north. And we disembarked there, and we had to, well, luckily it was June, so it was warm, because we had to wait for about a couple of days and nights to this little ship that went up and down the river, came, and we were taken down about 200 kilometers or so. And then when we got there, they had transport for the luggage, but we had to walk, I don't know, maybe 10 kilometers, something of that kind, it really was like a camp for political prisoners. There were three such camps, sort of a distance of maybe 10 kilometers from each other. One was on the river and the others were a bit further in. And we just had to walk until we got there. There were barracks and there were the watchtowers, but we were not the kind of people who were likely to run away. Where would we run to? There's primeval forest, there is a river, there's nowhere to run to. And we were put in these barracks, which unfortunately, of course, it's all logs, wood logs, timber is the principal industry. And you have bed bugs in the timber. Even the trees that actually grow in the forest have bed bugs.
Oh,
so you can imagine.
That was the summer where you made the log, you put the logs together.
When the people actually decided that another winter in Siberia would be just too much, they went to the river where the logs were, because logging was the industry, and they tied the logs together, making rafts, and then they tied the rafts together, and the rest of us who were still left in the camp all embarked on this. But it was October, so there was sleet and rain and cold, and we had no shelter, and our family personally, we really had no food. It was quite a horrible journey.
How long you were going?
Well, we were just floating down the river with the current till we got to the station Asino, which is, I can show it to you on the map. Now I'm trying to see the River Chulim I'm looking for. Now, Tomsk, that's right. Now the River Chulim must be somewhere here. Kuznetsky, it's Asino, there you are, Asino. So Tomsk was like the nearest big town. There is Asino. And that's the River Chulim, yes.
And that was the river you went down?
That's the
Where did you start from?
From, well, Asino. The train got as far as this.
Right.
And then we had to go down this river to him. My cousin in America, the one who was just a baby, he actually got this on his, you know, he's on the computer mm-hmm. and he knows all about it. Mm-hmm. He's a professor of geology. Mm-hmm. And he actually got the whole thing, mm-hmm. or, you know, was able to pinpoint the camp.
Uh-huh.
And last, he got in correspondence with a professor in Tomsk
mm-hmm.
and arranged to go there. And then he actually went to the camp where he had been as a child.
I just think it's absolutely incredible that he survived as, you know, as a, such a young age.
Well,
and he was on the raft as well this
time. Oh, yes. In fact, he remembers that someone tried to cook on the raft. And so they made a fire.
Oh,
and of course the logs took fire.
No.
And he remembers being passed from hand to hand away from this fire.
That's remarkable. And how long was your journey without food?
Well, we must have been a good few days. I mean, 200 kilometers sort of going with just floating down the river.
With no food?
It must have been about a week. Well, my mother managed to get some oats, but they were not like porridge oats that we have
mm-hmm.
here for porridge. They were really oats that you feed to horses.
Mm.
And she made sort of with water, sort of cakes with it, and I personally could not swallow it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very rough.
Yes, it'd be very coarse.
Very rough.
But you must have also had to take water with you as well.
Fresh water?
I think
water?
Must have been the water from the
right.
river that was
mm-hmm.
boiled.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is how there was a fire on the raft.
My goodness.
And we got to Asido. Now, they took us to Siberia. We didn't have to buy a ticket.
Right.
But when we were leaving Siberia, we got to Asino and had to get on a train, also cattle tracks, not a passenger train. We had to buy a ticket.
And you had no money.
And we had no money. And my mother still had her navy blue suit, and she took it into town on a sort of bazaar, and
mm-hmm.
she sold it in order to have money to buy tickets. And we got onto this train, and we were going to the Asian republics because, of course, by this time, you know, the Germans were advancing into Russia, so we couldn't go into Russia proper. It had to be the Asian republics. And that was a very long journey, and again, we had really no food. It was quite a difficult journey. And we got to Kazakhstan. Thousands.
Ah.
I mean, Stalin transported hundreds of thousands of Poles to Siberia.
Right, and they ended up in...
And then we were allowed to leave, so people came to the train when we stopped. Alma-Ata, which is now called Almaty, but was used to be called Alma-Ata, which means father of apples, because the apples apparently in Kazakhstan are wonderful. And I remember them saying, why don't we get off there, because it's very nice there. But we stayed on the train, and then it went through Tashkent, Samarkand, and Bukhara was the last stop. The train didn't go any further, so we got off. And of course the weather was wonderful, because end of October in Bukhara, it's just beautiful. The summer is very, very hot. Instead of being minus 50 like in Siberia, you can get up to plus 50, which is a bit too much. But it, you know, it was a lovely place with lots of trees and, you know, mulberry trees and all kinds of things.
And did they choose to go to the end of the line because it was the furthest away from the
Well, we got off
the
there and each one of, you know, my mother's brother and my mother's sister, and we each rented a little room, a tiny little room. And then my father started looking for work, but he was so afraid of the communist Russians because he was the son of a big landowner. And if there was anybody they had their knife into, it was big landowners. They really didn't like them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just scared. So he just went to work on a kolkhoz, you know, the like communal farm,
mm-hmm.
as just a worker. So unfortunately, because he only came home for Sunday, which was his day off, you know, the sanitary conditions were very poor, to say the least. Water was very scarce, as in a hot country it always is. And lice were everywhere. I mean, even the people who have always lived there, the Uzbeks, because this is Uzbekistan, they all had lice. So you couldn't get away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And typhus is carried by lice.
Mm-hmm.
And my father got typhus. He was taken to hospital. And then my mother got typhus. And the night she was taken to hospital, he died.
Oh, dear.
And I was 10 years old by this time. I was just 10 in January, and this was beginning of February. And my uncle came and packed up the bedding
mm.
and the few things that we had. We had very, very little by this time.
Mm.
And took me to where he, with his wife and baby son, who by now it was 1942, so my cousin was just 4.
Mm.
His mother had also had typhus, but she had come back from hospital. She survived. Now, my father died, and nobody told me my father died.
Mm.
My mother was in hospital, and on a Sunday, when my uncle wasn't working, he would take me to go to hospital to see my mother, and I said, and I want to see my father. Oh, no, you can't see him. He's there behind this window, but you can't see him. They never told me. I didn't find out my father was dead till my mother came out of hospital.
Really?
And of course she was so ill, they couldn't tell her until she got better.
Mm. They probably thought they were being kind to you, but they weren't.
So I stayed with this aunt and uncle and baby son, and my aunt, my mother's brother's wife. I remember their wedding in Tarnów, which was a beautiful wedding.
Mm.
And I remember when my cousin was born. I was 6 when he was born. And she, of course, being after a severe illness, was mostly in bed, resting. And I was sent to the bazaar shopping before I went to school. I did the cooking. I did the cleaning.
You were only 10.
My cousin had to be washed, but you just had a basin. You put water in the basin and you stood the child in and you washed him. You know, at 10 years old, I was a maid of all work.
Mm.
Unfortunately, my aunt did not behave too well to me. Well, I was an orphan to all intents and purposes. My mother might not survive, so I'm totally dependent, totally. So finally, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I told my uncle that the way she was behaving to me, I couldn't stand it, and I'd like to go to my other aunt, my mother's sister. So
your mother was still in hospital?
My mother was in hospital, and it was touch and go.
Right.
So I had to carry all the stuff across town, because my aunt lived at the other end of town. But my aunt was okay. She treated me the way she treated her son, you know. If she was annoyed, she shouted, and otherwise she was okay. It was quite different to the way my uncle's wife treated me. And then finally my mother came out of hospital. Now she was a very small woman. The joke way back before my aunt and my mother were married was that the Miss Ecksteins can walk with an umbrella under a table. Because they were about 4'10".
Mm.
They were very small.
Very small.
And their mother obviously was small as well, judging by that photograph, you know. But she was quite a strong personality, very strong personality. And so my mother, when she came out of hospital, she looked like a child because she was so thin, there was absolutely nothing off her. And of course her hair had all been cut completely, very, very short. And she was just not worth tuppence. And she went to stay with her sister where I was already. And not long after that, she took ill with dysentery.
Oh.
Now on top of what she had been through, she nearly died.
Yeah,
again.
Again.
She was really dying. And this doctor came. He was a Jewish doctor from Poland. And she said to him, "My child has already lost her father. If I die, what will happen to her?" And he got me to go with him, and he gave me a little bottle of opium drops. And she took these opium drops, and that seemed to help her, because otherwise she was just going to die. So she managed to survive that.
Amazing.
She must have had an incredibly strong will. I mean, as you said, she lived
to 104.
104 and a half.
This
is a donation I gave to Witzo in her name, in her memory.
She must have been a very strong person to.
Well,
to get
you see,
this.
She had such a privileged upbringing. As a, you know, it was a very wealthy family, very wealthy family. You know, when she was born in 1904, that part of Poland, Kraków, Tarnów, etc., that was called Galicia, and it belonged to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they traveled to Vienna like we would travel to London, you know. My uncles were educated in Vienna. In fact, the First World War, the whole family spent in Vienna. They were brought up speaking German as well as Polish. They had a governess teaching them French. Only my grandmother Matilda, when it was the cook's day off, she would make the girls come into the kitchen and make them cook and bake. And my mother's sister especially, she rebelled. "Why should I have to do this?" She said, "You never know when it may come in useful."
And she was right.
She was absolutely right, because the fact that my mother could cook is what saved us. Because then she got it, well, when she recovered from the typhus and the dysentery, the Polish sort of, by this time, there was a sort of Polish government in Moscow, sort of government in exile. There was one in London and there was one in Moscow. And they sort of had so-called delegatura, which was a sort of people in charge. And people from abroad would send things for us poor people, you know, clothes and shoes and all sorts of things. But I'm sorry to say that not everybody who was in charge was honest. So by this time my mother had no shoes, her feet were wrapped in rags. I ran around barefoot, and she was really in a very poor state. And they were looking for a cook for the nursery school that they opened for the small children, because in Russia you go to school at 8 years old. So between, say, 4 and 8, they opened a sort of nursery. So my mother got a job as a cook, because it was just a day nursery, but you gave them lunch, which consisted of soup. That's all she could cook, because there was nothing else. But she did the best she could with the products that they gave her. And the children all loved Mrs. Chantal's soup. And I was by this time in an orphanage.
Oh.
Which I hated.
Because your mother couldn't afford to look after you?
My mother couldn't feed me. She couldn't feed me. She put me in an orphanage.
Oof. What? What?
And I hated the orphanage.
I'm sure you did.
I really did hate the orphanage. And my dream was that one day my mother would knock on the gate and come and say, "I'm taking you away from here."
Did she have time to visit you? Did she visit you in the orphanage?
Well, we were actually brought into Bukhara to attend school. The orphanage was out of town a bit, so we were brought into town to attend school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry to say I was very bad, because I would run away and go to this little nursery school where I knew my mother was cooking, and she would give me a plate of soup, and I would cry into the soup and say, I don't want to go back, I don't want to go back. But, you know, I had to go back.
Yeah,
I had to go back.
Must have been very hard for her as well. Awful.
Because I didn't hear what was going on, I didn't know what was going on, I was away, whatever book I was reading, I was away.
It's quite amazing to think that somebody so small, you know, so tiny and fragile, could go through such awful experiences, terrible illnesses, life-threatening illnesses, and yet...
Well, I mean,
that she sort of decided,
Bukhara,
I'm going to live there, and that's what I'm going to do. And
in Bukhara, because of the heat, of course, we were plagued with mosquitoes.
Mm.
And my mother had malaria very badly. She used to get dreadful bouts of malaria. I only had one bout of malaria, and I tell you, it was pretty awful, because you are running such a high temperature that although there is tremendous heat outside, you know, like 35 degrees, 40 degrees, you are shaking with cold, and she piled quilts on top of me to, you know, but I was given quinine, a large, you know, sort of course of quinine, and that seemed to, I didn't get it again, but she kept getting recurring bouts of malaria. How she survived so long is a mystery. And why didn't I get typhus and dysentery and all these things that people got and died of? I mean, we lived in such close proximity. It wasn't like you could keep away from people. You couldn't.
My aunt came to London to meet the transport of children that Dr. Schoenfeld brought from Poland.
So, sorry, can you go back a wee bit and say, who was Dr. Schoenfeld?
Well, Rabbi Solomon Schoenfeld was a rabbi in London, and
right.
He realized that after the war, a lot of children, of course, millions perished. All our family, nearly all perished, except for us who were in Russia during the war. That's how we survived.
And why were you in Russia? How were you in Russia?
Oh, that is a very long story. Well, my mother was terribly afraid of the Nazi Germans. And she really wanted to sell all the property and come to England before the war, because my aunt, my father's sister, was already in Oxford. She was a scientist, and she had got her BSc and PhD from Krakow University in chemistry, and then she worked in the Institute Pasteur in Paris, and she returned to Poland, I think, just when my parents were getting married. And she would have liked an academic career, and the Krakow University, which is a very famous university, very old, said yes, no problem, because they knew her as a first-class student and, you know, very hard-working. There was only one little problem. She was Jewish. If she would get baptized Catholic, no problem. So, of course, there was no way. My grandparents were very Orthodox. In fact, for her to study was already, you know, quite extraordinary from such an Orthodox family. But she was extremely strong-willed. She was only 18 months younger than my father. Two older siblings had died. And anything my father did, she did only better. So anything he was learning, she learned right there with him. So when he studied for his bar mitzvah, she was right there with him. So she knew everything. She was really extraordinary. And so she wouldn't get baptized. So she waited for an opportunity, how she could get maybe to Britain and do some work here.
And there was a professor came, I can't remember if it's Oxford or Cambridge, but anyway, she spoke to him. And in November 1938, she actually came to England. I have a journal here, which I just got last December.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a whole long article about my aunt in it.
Really, bulletin of for the history of chemistry.
Quite a remarkable woman.
Regina Chantal.
Chantal, that's my maiden name. So she actually worked in Oxford in the Sir William Dunn School of Pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working on penicillin.
Oh my goodness.
With all the people who later got their Nobel Prize and FRS. And she missed out on it because, well, there was... my head.
Mm-hmm.
No, there was Professor Florey who was in charge. Because although Fleming discovered the penicillin, it was terribly unstable and it was very difficult to get it purified and extracted and crystallized and so on. So there was Ernest Chain, who was a refugee from Germany, and he was a brilliant scientist, but I think she didn't like him personally.
Yeah.
And she worked quite, she's mentioned in all the books, in Fleming's biography, in Florey's biography, in Chain's biography, because I have these books. She's in the photographs. But she went to Professor Florey and said, I can't work with this man, give me something else to do. And I think that's how she started on cancer research. And that's how she missed out on the Nobel Prize.
And that's amazing.
And the FRS. But anyway, after some years, she corresponded with Professor Cook, who was professor of chemistry in Glasgow. And he was a great carcinogen specialist. So she came to work in Glasgow. So that after the war, when I came with this transport of children, I arrived in Glasgow, otherwise I would have been in Oxford.
And the rabbi you mentioned just took it upon himself to rescue these children.
Well,
including
I
himself.
Mean, some people paid for the transport.
Mm-hmm.
Some children had absolutely nobody and they didn't. As far as I am aware, my mother paid for me in Poland and my aunt paid for me in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So that some other child who had nobody could come, you know. A lot of children went to some orphanages or hostels that he ran, but my aunt came to London and took me straight off the transport.
And so you stayed with her, did you? Is that
so? Well, I knew no English.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Russian and Polish very well, but no English. So I came to Glasgow and stayed with her, and she sent me to Laurel Bank because she worked at the university. She lived in Byers Road, renting two rooms from a landlady. And so the school was just up the road, which was very convenient. And the school was very good to me because I really could not speak a word of English.
And they gave you special support, did they, at the
and
time?
And they were very kind and very good. So that after 3 years at school, well, I arrived in November in 15. On the 14th of January, I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I left school when I was 18 and a half. So in that time, I managed to get all my hires.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, that's
yes,
really
very
quite
impressive, isn't it?
Amazing.
Well, the most amazing part is that my school friends, with whom I still keep in touch, some of them, have not forgiven me to this day.
Why?
Because you were not given at that time, you know, you had to take your hires all in one lot. You couldn't take two
mm-hmm.
subjects here, three subjects there. You had to do it in the one lot. And you weren't told what marks you had. The only thing was the headmistress, Miss Glover, would ask the inspector who came top so she could award a prize. And when it came to English, I got the prize.
That's marvellous.
Which was terrible after 3 years in this country.
Oh, that's marvellous.
But it shows how determined you were as well, I think, to learn.
Well,
English.
I was always a voracious reader, so I always read an awful lot, and I think this was it. And I was a very naughty girl, because during break, when you were supposed to be outside in the fresh air, mostly it was cold and wet, so I hated it. I sneaked into the library and I read. And funnily enough, a lot of the books that I read, obviously nobody else ever took them out, because they were always there for me to read whenever I came in.
And with your aunt, did you speak in English or did
no,
you?
No, we spoke Polish,
in,
but very
English.
Fortunately, because she had spent time in Paris, she knew French as well. And so I took English, I took French, I took chemistry, physics, mathematics, and history, and the most difficult subject of all was arithmetic, because of course I was used to the decimal system and the British system of weights and measures and coins was just dreadful. I was very good at geometry, algebra, trigonometry, no trouble, but pence, you know, halfpennies, farthings, shillings, oh, that was so difficult.
And your mother by that time was over?
My mother had remained in Poland.
Oh,
because
right.
She had remarried. That's why she was called Sabina Hammer, because her second husband was Isaac Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1951, my mother had always wanted to go to Israel, always. And she married. We came back to Poland. We were repatriated in May of 1946. After many, many vicissitudes, my stepfather became director of a Polish orphanage. And my mother by that time was with him. And out of the horrible orphanage that it used to be, my stepfather made really something that people used to come and admire, because there was such a change. He completely transformed it. With my mother's help, I must say, the power behind the throne, my mother really was very, very good about telling him what he should do. She was quite a remarkable person, she really was. And so we were repatriated in actually passenger trains this time, not cattle trucks, back to Poland in May of 46. And of course the shock of coming back and finding that the whole family has perished. And the communist government had nationalized everything, nationalized the factories, distributed the land that was my grandfather's among the peasants. And the danger was that if we showed our face in the town where my grandfather lived, we would be murdered, because the peasants would say, oh, these Jews have come to reclaim their property. Right. That's because 26 Jews were killed not far away from there in July of 46. It was known as the Kielce pogrom. They had survived the war, came back, and the Poles killed them. So my mother, it was really that decided my mother to send me to Britain, to my aunt. Meantime, you know, I was sent to school in September. I went to school in Krakow, but only for a couple of months, because then in November, that was that, I was sent over here. It was quite traumatic, because I was very attached to my mother, and I hadn't seen my aunt since I was 6 years old. And of course, for my aunt to be saddled with a teenager was not easy. 1950-51, Stalin unleashed an anti-Semitic campaign. You know, there was the doctor's so-called plot and so on. It got worse and worse being Jewish, and Poland was totally under Russian domination, completely. And it was difficult even to get away to Israel. It wasn't easy at all. But my mother was determined to emigrate, and he didn't. So they got divorced. I remember being quite upset about it because he was a very nice man.
Mm-hmm.
But she got divorced, and at that time when you were leaving Poland, they literally counted how many pairs of knickers, how many blouses, how many skirts. You were so restricted as to what you were able to take away. It was quite ridiculous. I mean, your personal clothes and things. It was dreadful. So she arrived in Israel by boat.
And you were already in Scotland by this time?
Well, yes, it was, I think, February 51. I was already in my medical studies doing my... Well, I left school 1950.
Right.
So I was at university when we celebrated the quincentenary, which was lovely. It was a wonderful year to be in because there were so many celebrations. It was quite fantastic. So in 51 in the summer, I went with a party of students to Israel, and I hadn't seen my mother since 1948, because in 1948 I went back to Poland on holiday, still on a Polish passport. There was at that time a Polish consulate in Glasgow, and I went with a friend, and she was a very charming lady, also from Poland, and she persuaded the consul to give me aller-retour visa, so that I wouldn't need to try and get a visa to return. I had it already in my Polish passport. So I spent too long in Poland. I went by ship from Southampton to Gdynia, which was quite an adventure for a 16-year-old.
What did you do after Laurel Banks school?
Oh, well, those were quite different days. I stayed when I finished school and was accepted for university to do medicine, because my hires were
absolutely
pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in the women's hostel, which was number 1 Lilybank Terrace. Laurel Bank was number 2, 3 and 4 Lilybank
mm-hmm.
Terrace.
Mm-hmm.
And number 1 was Robertson Hall, which was part of Queen Margaret Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lovely house in a garden just a few steps away. But so I started medicine, and my aunt left the chemistry department and started working in the cancer hospital, which was facing Garnet Hill Shoe. Now, we used to go to Garnet Hill Shoe with my aunt on Yom Tevim, because my aunt was a real workaholic. She worked every minute of the day and sometimes through the night. If she had a experiment going that had to be watched, she was there all night as well. Come home in the morning, have a bath, have breakfast, go straight back to the lab. She was a workaholic. And she changed, and the top floor of the cancer hospital, it was research, there was Dr. Peacock was in charge. He and his wife worked there. And there was Dr. Beck, who was a pathologist. He was a refugee from Germany. And his wife, Dr. Herta Beck, was a GP in Tall Cross.
Mm.
They had no children. And Shortly, I was accepted for medicine, and my aunt was working there, and she came home one day and said Dr. Beck had invited her for coffee, and she said her niece stayed with her. We said, bring her along. So we went, they lived far away out. You went by number 9 tram car practically to the very end of Ochenshugel, and they had a house there. Now, she had a practice in Tall Cross, and Henry had a practice in Bridgeton. And she had not been well and asked Henry if he could help her to do some home visits. She invited him for coffee as well. And this is how I met my husband, Henry. But I was just 18. I was there with my aunt, and this gentleman was there. Of course, 9 years older when you are 18, you know, to me it was just... But I remember going home in a tram car afterwards, and my aunt said to me, you made an impression. And I looked at her in astonishment, you know, because this gentleman was completely out of my sphere. So there you are, that's how I met Henry.
And did you carry on studying medicine?
Well, then he proposed to me not very long afterwards.
Well, you know, he had gone through lots, I think. Was that not a generation that...
Well, he invited me out and we went out a few times. But father-in-law got a practice in London, so Henry was born in London and his mother unfortunately died shortly afterwards. So his aunt and uncle brought him up because his mother's sister had no children. So she took him and brought him up. So he was brought up in London till war broke out when he was 16. And he was supposed to study medicine in London. But because of the war, his father made him come to Glasgow. And that's how Henry was in Glasgow.
So how old were you then when you were married?
I was 20.
And you gave up medicine?
Well, the understanding was Henry had a big 10-roomed house and a housekeeper. The understanding was I would carry on with my studies.
As well as running the whole house.
And the housekeeper was running the house, and that was the understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, I wasn't going to give up. Well, you know, he proposed to me. I said, no, no, and ran away. Then he proposed to me a year later again. He can't live without me. So it was on the understanding I would carry on.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, in those days there was no pill.
Yeah.
And before you could say very much, I was pregnant. And when I was pregnant, I was sick all the time. And I got thinner and thinner. Food just made, the smell of food made me sick. And finally, I mean, I just literally could not lift my arm. So finally, Henry called in an obstetrician to have a look at me. And he pinched my arm. I always remember him pinching like that. And now there is fat, but at that time there was just skin, nothing else. And he said to me, girl, you are on the point of starvation, no more university for you.
And that was it?
And that was it. So I had Nina, and 2 years later I had Peter. And of course, being a GP's wife, it was a 24-hour job, 7 days a week.
Because people phoned...
Unless you had somebody in the house who would answer the phone and take a message, you had to be there to answer the phone. You were on duty all the time. So the housekeeper left when I told her I was pregnant again, you know, with my second child. So that was the end of the housekeeper. And, you know, but I had a daily woman 5 days a week every morning. But it was really... It was a full-time job being a GP's wife. Also, you know, some patients came to the house. There were two rooms which were for patients, as well as a sitting room, dining room. Then there were the premises at the back. And then there was a great big staircase with a great big stained glass window and the grandfather clock, and then another flight of stairs. And four big rooms and a bathroom there, and then there were two rooms in the attic.
That would keep you fit.
It was a huge house for a 20-year-old girl. It was daunting.
Especially when you had been used to sharing a small room with three other families.
Well,
that must have been a very strange culture
shock.
It
was.
When did your mother come to join you?
Oh no, my mother. My mother, meantime, decided that she was going to study beauty culture.
She must have been some person.
And she attended classes. It was a 2-year course because it included massage and it included actually making of cosmetics and creams. It wasn't just makeup. It was quite a deep study. And she did very, very well. And my stepfather didn't want to go to Israel, and my mother was determined to go. Don't forget that Stalin did not die till 1953.
But your mother must have ended, well, we know she came
Well, she
to
worked as a beautician in Israel all those years. She came to Glasgow when Nina was born in 1953. And then she came again in 55 when Peter was born. And then she used to come every 2 years or so to visit for July and August, you know, the hottest months. She didn't, well, when she finally stopped working, which was, she was well in her 70s, she would come, I would go over there in May and then bring her back with me, and then after Yontif I would take her back again. But by the age of 84, when I went there, her doctor told me that she had breast cancer and only had a year or two to live. So I brought her to live with us in June of 89. Well, she lived 20 years after that. Which I'm sure the surgeon would be very surprised if he knew.
So one of the things we always do in reflection is ask about the nice things. And although, Marion, you've talked quite a lot about how horrendous it was about losing your parents and...
Which was my father.
Your father. Oh, sorry, your father. And how wonderful it was that your mother lived.
Yes.
And you married very happily. But you haven't really talked very much about your family. So do you want to tell us a wee bit about...
Well, I had the two children very young, when I was 21 and 23. And then we moved house. We moved from that very, very big house in Bridgeton, which had always been a doctor's house, to a very nice bungalow in Pollock Shields, and with a lovely big garden. And I was very fond of gardening, so was Henry. But he didn't have much time, so really I cut the grass and I pruned the roses and I did all that. We always bought nice plants when we went anywhere, so we really had some beautiful plants in the garden. And I wanted another baby in this lovely, put the pram out into this lovely garden. And Henry said, no, not having any more, absolutely not. And then Nina finished school. And she was going to Norlands College to be a Norland nanny. She was very fond of children. But they wouldn't take her till she was 18, and she was only 17. So I sent her to be an au pair in Paris, because I had friends in Paris. And she was there for 7 or 8 months and came back speaking perfect French.
Fantastic.
Did very, very well, yes. Peter was at school, he was 15, he was very busy with his friends and sport and so on. And so I went to Langside College to do a secretarial course. I thought I could maybe do that sort of on and off to fit in with my life. And I was doing very well with shorthand, typing, accountancy, everything. And then I began to feel very unwell. And I couldn't bear the smell of the dining room. And I got thinner and thinner. And it turned out I was pregnant.
Right.
And that's when I had Alice. I had to give up my studies because my blood pressure dropped down. I just was sick 3 times a day, not just morning sickness. Obviously, girls don't agree with me. I was sick with Nina as well. I was fine with Peter. And with Alice, I was really, really bad. Well, I was 38, and she was born end of July when I was 39 in 71. And, of course, she was a wonderful baby, and I was walking on air. I thought it was the best thing I had ever done.
Absolutely, because you have the time and you have the experience.
Yes.
Do you not find with your third you're much more relaxed?
Oh, yes.
About it all?
Oh, but she was a lovely, lovely child. Absolute blessing. Of course, my mother came from Israel to help me. And my mother was wonderful. She really was wonderful. And so that was the end of my studies as a secretary. But it did help me to do the books for Henry so that I was able to do that. And of course, Alice has been an absolute blessing because she did very well at school. She did very well at university.
So what did she study at university?
I wanted her to study pharmacy, but she had excellent hires. She could have applied for anything, but no accountancy. And when it came to the graduation, it was on Saturday, and by this time she had become very orthodox and she wouldn't graduate on Saturday. Alice went to Manchester to work in an accountant's office, but as she became so very frum, and the Holy Law Synagogue was looking for an administrator to put things on the computer because the people who had worked there for years didn't want to do that. So they took her on, and she did very well there. And then my aunt died and left, well, the proceeds of her flat were divided between us all. And each child spent the money differently. Nina bought a car and invested the rest. Peter was just having his 40th birthday at the time, so he had a marquee, a jazz band.
Fantastic.
120 people.
That sounded absolutely in the wonderful.
It was a wonderful party, yes. And Alice used the money to go to SEM in Harnoff.
Oh, right.
To study Jewish religion. And my goodness, she certainly studied that. And that's where she met her husband.
Very nice.
And he came of a non-Orthodox family, and he had finished university, I think, in Denver, Colorado, where he comes from, and was going to do law. But he went to Israel meantime for a few months and decided to become religious and went to Or Sameach
Yeshiva.
And that's how they met.
Lovely.
They've got four lovely boys.
And they live in?
They live in Edgware now.
In Edgware?
Yes.
And they have four boys?
Yeah, the two boys were born in Jerusalem until he finished his studies. And then he got a job in Leeds as a student chaplain to Yorkshire Universities. And she had another boy in Leeds, that was Shloimeh. And then he got a job in JFS in London, teaching religion. So they moved to Edgware, and she had little Moshe in London.
Lovely.
So that's how I have four children from Peter, a boy and three girls.
Oh my goodness, four there as well. And so are they older? Are they...
Oh yes, they are older, yes. Oh yes. Sam finished Warwick University and got a job, very fortunately, with AXA.
Oh, right.
So he's doing well there. Katie is now 21. She's in her final year in York doing French and history. Anna is in her second year at Leicester. And Lucy will be 18 at the end of December. She's in her final year at Maidstone Grammar School.
My goodness. And Nina has an interesting job, I think, as well, doesn't she?
Well, Nina... When she went to France, after she finished Norrlands, and they have to do private nannying to get the Norrlands certificate. And she got a job with a family. I think they had a six-year-old girl and a baby. And they lived in Kensington, and they had some estate in the borders in Scotland. So she thought she would take that job. But by the time she actually came to take the job, they had sold up in this country and bought a chateau in the south of France, in Bar-sur-Loup or Tourette-sur-Loup, which is not far from Grasse. And it's the perfume industry there. So she worked there, and of course she made friends with all the staff, because they had staff. They had somebody, you know, a cook, and a gardener and a housekeeper, etc.
It sounds very Downton Abbey.
Absolutely, absolutely. So she worked there for about 9 months, and then she came back to Glasgow, got a job in a nursery in Battlefield, which was slightly different, but she decided she wanted to go to Canada. Henry's two younger brothers lived in Canada, one in Manitoba, one in Ottawa. So she wanted to emigrate to Canada, and having French as well as English, she did the applications and so on, and she emigrated. So she lived in Canada for about 8 years. And Then she decided to go backpacking around Europe. And when she got back to south of France to visit, and she got this job in the perfume industry, a secretarial job.
Right.
She got training, about 3 months training she got, and she liked it, and they were very nice people. It's a big firm. They don't do a sort of retail.
Mm-hmm.
It's all wholesale. It's all export. And wholesale big quantities of all the things that they use in the perfume industry. So she's been working there now for over 20 years.
Fantastic.
Oh, it's a beauty. The whole thing looks like a film set.
Mm-hmm.
It really is lovely.
But she has lovely nephews and nieces.
Oh,
which is
yes,
lovely.
She's very fond of them. She always comes to see them.
And if you look back, Marion, and if you think about where you started as a child, and now you're being done,
I've been very lucky.
Have lovely children and lovely grandchildren.
Yes, yes. So well, if Hitler had his way, there would be nothing. So we were very lucky that they took us to Siberia. Yes.
I know. But I think your life has been absolutely fantastic, and it's been a real privilege to interview you. Thank you very much, Marion.
Thank you, Angela.